Hello, and thank you for joining us for the 110th episode of the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. I'm Sue Colvin, co-host of the Fisheries Pod, and this week we take a deep dive into electrofishing. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook, or support the podcast on Patreon. If you are interested in showing your support for the show or a favorite fish species, please check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find cozy, cool t-shirts, hats, stickers, and more. In this recently recorded episode, I'm joined by Arkansas Tech graduate student Emily Jonigan. Emily and I interview Jim Reynolds and Ellen Temple, two electrofishing experts, to learn more about increasing the effective and safe application of this fisheries gear. We discuss basic and emerging technologies, differences in waveforms, and when to use them, lethal and sublethal impacts of electrofishing, and how to minimize these. We discuss which fish species are more likely to evade capture, and why, and which species are more or less likely to be injured, and why. We also discuss optimizing sampling methodologies across electrofishing units. It's a primer of all things electrofishing with some of the best minds on this topic. We'll join the recording now, where I welcome Emily. Enjoy the show. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you, Sue. It's great to be here. I'm excited to learn more from Jim and Alan about electrofishing. It's going to be a great episode.
Thank you so much for helping me with this. Can you let us know a little bit about your project and how you've utilized electrofishing in your research?
Sure. So for my project, I have used both gill nets and electrofishing to sample sauger. I'm looking into the genetic distribution of sauger in the Arkansas River and how navigational dams may or may not be impacting their population structure. I've used both electrofishing this past summer and in the fall when sauger are more widely distributed. And then I switched over to gill nets in the winter when they congregate below the dams.
So why are you particularly interested in sauger genetic diversity on the Arkansas River?
Right. So there really hasn't been much research into sauger genetics in Arkansas really at all. From a management perspective, I think it would be really interesting to know if there are kind of more distinct populations due to that separation from the dams, and if the dams are having a negative impact on their migration and maybe on genetic diversity if they aren't really able to mix due to those barriers.
That's fantastic. And I promise our listeners that we will re-record a podcast focused on Emily and her research. So our guests this week are experts in electrofishing, an important sampling technique in the field of freshwater fisheries. First, please welcome Jim Reynolds, Professor Emeritus of Fisheries Ecology from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Jim's written many papers on electrofishing and co-author of the electrofishing chapter in the Fisheries Techniques books. I'm really glad that he's here to share some of his electrofishing knowledge. So welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Sue and Emily. It's a pleasure to participate in the Fisheries podcast.
So riding shotgun for the electrofishing pod with Jim is Alan Temple. Alan Temple is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service fish and wildlife biologist and a curriculum manager at the National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Welcome, Alan.
Well, anytime I get to talk electrofishing with Jim Reynolds is an exceptional day, and even more special doing so on the Fisheries Podcast. Thank you for inviting me, Sue and Emily.
Oh, great. Well, I think we mentioned it later on in our show notes, but I met Jim and Helen on the banks of the Truckee electrofishing. And so I've been wanting to talk with them in more detail about that. And so they've been gracious enough to come and visit with us on the podcast. So Jim and Alan, you've both spent a large part of your careers dedicated not only to better understanding fish, but also one of our most important field techniques, electrofishing. I'd first like to ask both of you, what drew you to focus your careers on this methodology, if you could address that?
My career focus on electrofishing was really a case of happenstance. As a master student at Iowa State University, I exclusively used electrofishing as my sampling method for smallmouth bass in the Des Moines River. Our electrofishing boat was primitive, to say the least. In those years, electrofishing itself was seldom studied and poorly understood. So I had curiosity, but no answers. About 15 years later, as assistant leader of the Missouri Cooperative Fishery Research Unit, I had several opportunities to study the strengths and limitations of sampling by boat electrofishing in Missouri and elsewhere. As a result, I published several papers on this topic. But the dramatic change came in the early 1980s when I was unit leader of the Alaska Cooperative Fishery Research Unit. As a result of those papers, I was asked by the American Fisheries Society to write a chapter on electrofishing for a new book, Fisheries Techniques, that was first published in 1983. And as a result of the book, I was asked to serve as instructor for the Fisheries Academy of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, a precursor to the National Conservation Training Center, or NCTC, that we have today. My first course was a five-day event in 1983 at Marquette, Michigan, where I met Larry Coles, an electrical engineer for the Fish and Wildlife Service in Denver, and also my co-instructor. Larry had developed a keen interest for electrofishing, even though he had little previous experience with the method. Our conversations continued after the course, as well as co-teaching many more courses over the years. As a result, we began studies together to develop a theory of electrofishing. With Larry's understanding of electrical science and mine of fishery science, I like to think that we had good success. I'll close my answer with a problem that we face in science, the parallelism nature of disciplines. Many disciplines are more related than we may first think. As long as these disciplines remain parallel, that is, never cross paths, we stumble along in our own pursuits. But when we engage across disciplines, there is always synergy and progress. And that, I think, is what happened when Larry and Jim first met in Marquette.
Fantastic, thank you. And Alan?
Your question is insightful, Sue, because focusing on methodology is not a common research pursuit of fisheries biologists. You know, few people study the tools used to accomplish tasks, and that makes sense. Fish biologists want to get answers to fisheries questions, and electrofishing gear often is the tool to get those results. However, you know, while not the goal of their work, paying attention to a few important gear fundamentals can pay off. So that said, my first research attempt was a gear comparison study that included electrified quadrats, or something called pre-positioned area shockers. This gear category is operated remotely. And actually, Carl Sullivan published on a remote shocking setup called Parallel Wires back in 1954 and still in use today in West Virginia by the DNR. So I was frustrated with the inefficiency of sampling glide habitats in larger streams with the more traditional electrofishing methods. And after talking with Mark Bain at Auburn about his remote sampling experiences, I became interested in ways to improve my effectiveness and did an experiment. And all this really woke me up to the fact that not all methods are equally effective in all habitats. About a year after that, then in 1991, I became employed at the Fish and Wildlife Service Fisheries Academy. And my first course was an electrofishing class taught by none other than Jim Reynolds and Larry Coles. I was just thinking pure technique at the time. And after the class, I came back with a new perspective on these underlying concepts and the benefits of theory to sampling, and really dove into the course materials that hooked me.
Could you both give a simple definition of electrofishing and how it works?
Well, distilled down to the basics, electrofishing is the application of electricity into water to control or to capture fish. Electrical current is used to cause a desired behavior as repel, guided movement, or a capture-prone response. How electrofishing is carried out, how the electrofishing system is configured, that affects safety, efficiency, precision, and risk of injury to fish.
I'll add that Alan's explanation is concise and accurate. And I'll say that electrofishing is achieved by using a batteries to a control unit where it is modified into an appropriate waveform, then on to the electrodes immersed in the water to create an electrical field. Although biologists often rely on circuit information such as voltage setting, it is in the electrical field where the fish are actually affected for capture or control.
Emily, do you want to pick up on the next question?
So what would you say are the general types of electrofishing for different aquatic environments for Alan?
Well, the first consideration I'd say is whether you're sampling wadeable or non-wadeable habitats in streams and lakes. So for non-wadeable areas, say deeper than 3 to 4 feet, the equipment of choice is boat or raft electrofishers. There are diverse control box models and electrode configurations used with this gear type. For shallower habitats that can be waded, then major factors to consider are stream width, flow, and water conductivity. In small streams with moderate conductivity and slower flow, backpack electrofishing can be effective by itself. If flow is significant, then you can combine backpack electrofishing into a seine. Pre-positioned area shockers have been found useful in these habitats as well. The electric seine, when the seine can span the stream width and sites are block netted, that's an effective gear type and has been used in Illinois and Virginia, especially. For wider streams, then one backpack every 3 to 5 meters is often effective. An alternative approach is shore-based or tow barge electrofishing that has multiple anodes. These gear types can include actually throwable anodes. By the way, you may need a tow barge or shore-based system to supply enough power to effectively sample in high conductivity reaches. So in riffle run habitats, consider backpack or tow barge shocking into a seine or using electrified quadrats. Boat electrofishers also have been used to sample these deeper riffle run areas while floating through from say one pool to the next, but this of course is not too efficient generally.
So to learn more, Jim, what references might you recommend for electrofishing in different habitats?
There are two general references that provide comprehensive information and are good starting points for folks who are new to electrofishing. These are the chapter in the third edition of Fisheries Techniques published by AFS in 2012 and authored by Larry Coles and myself. The other is the second edition published in 2016 by Wiley in the US. It has the title Electricity in Fish Research and Management and is authored by William Beaumont. Beaumont lives in Britain and is an innovative researcher in electrofishing. Those needing more detailed and specific information are going to have to research the peer-reviewed journal literature.
Well, thank you for that, Jim. I didn't know about the Beaumont book, so I myself will check that out. Mm-hmm. What are some of the major safety tips? Because that's really something that we should talk about on the front end of a podcast on electrofishing. So, Alan, what are some of those major safety tips you would like to share for each type of electrofishing unit?
Well, for any gear, never, ever, ever, ever handle both polarity electrodes with the power source running or plugged in. Believe it or not, this is how some serious accidents have occurred with boats and rafts. An example of this is standing on the bow of the boat or on the bottom of a stream and working on a retracted anode with the generator running. The best practice is to unplug the booms before handling the electrodes. In boats and rafts, make sure all metal surfaces are in electrical continuity or physically connected with each other in some manner. So you want to be a bird on a wire when you're in a boat. Tow barge and shore-based shocking have possibly the highest risk because you're wading in an electric field generated by a power level similar to that of boats. So always station an operator nearby who can quickly cut off power at the generator or the control box in case someone falls in. Do not just depend upon anode safe handle safety switches. The tow barge driver should also have a safety switch as well in case she falls into the water, you know, behind the barge. If backpacks are older models and have metal control boxes, always handle that box with gloves. If you are in misty weather conditions as occur in the Northwest, keep the backpack dry with a rain cover. If you're building your own equipment, follow National Electric Code. And the Fish and Wildlife Service Electrification Safety Policy that you can get online has design guidelines. And yeah, like I said, you can find it on a Google search. So no running the main conductor through the low voltage safety switch, for instance. Yeah, that's it.
So Emily, I know that the next question is yours, but I'm just going to, I just want to insert a small question there because who builds their own electrofishing equipment? How often does that happen? Is that like a common thing?
Address that to me, Sue?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Alan. So you said if you're building your own, and yeah. I mean, does that happen a lot?
Oh, sure. it does. Now, some agencies, like say in Canada, they say no non-commercially built equipment. But a lot of state agencies build their own equipment, universities. Well, you know, they might buy the control box from a major manufacturer, but the wiring and that sort of thing goes up with the boat. It's mostly boats and rafts we see that. DNRs, yeah, that's very common.
Okay. Actually,
because of the expense.
Right. Yeah. Right. I've seen some homemade barges that are... It belong in a museum, but not on the stream, maybe. So, all right, Emily, you want to go for it?
Right, yeah. So to continue with the safety topic here, do you, and this is for both of you really, do you think that human safety is prioritized enough in the current electrofishing trainings and protocols?
Well, I will say there are good examples of emphasizing safety. For instruction, the Fish and Wildlife Service Principles and Techniques of Electrofishing course is mandated for crew leader safety training by the Electrofishing Safety Policy. So definitely safety guidance is there. There's an online electrofishing safety class is mandated as well for other crew members, including volunteers. The USGS has similar training. The Northwest Environmental Training Center, electrofishing courses Jim has taught have had a good safety coverage. Some state agencies, as the Missouri Department of Conservation, want to highlight them, have thorough coverage of safety in their in-house offerings. Other countries as Australia emphasize safe operation via their code of practice. But of course, some states don't have safety policies, and that's true. So protocols, at least to the extent of my understanding, typically don't include safety concerns. But this is where an agency level policy comes in. And more state agencies are developing safety policies to guide, you know, safety practices of field crews. And in fact, I was recently supplying information to a state agency in the early process of building a policy. So the good news here is that agencies do not have to reinvent the wheel and can work off existing policies as those of the Fish and Wildlife Service, the USGS, or state agencies as the Missouri Department of Conservation. All this said, there are some out of bounds things that are go on and as electrofishing manufacturers will let you know.
Jim here, I will add some safety advice that I offer in my courses. Electrofishing crew leaders and other responsible personnel should ask themselves a tough question requiring serious introspection. And that is, if a serious accident occurred during our electrofishing, would our operations withstand independent investigation? Once an accident occurs, it is too late to address an issue, whether related to the equipment or its use. Think of the potential for liability and vulnerability if a state OSHA got involved. I recommend that permanent project personnel meet annually for serious objective self-evaluation.
Good advice.
Definitely. All right, so switching gears here a little bit, but I know we have all probably had experiences with field work where you come across members of the public, whether it's at a boat ramp, talking to, some fishermen. So if someone has concerns about electrofishing specifically and they approach you about that, the safety of the fish and if you're harming the fish or someone asks if you're going to kill the fish, how do you respectfully respond to that situation?
Well, I think this is one of the great unresolved conundrums in electrofishing. In fact, I just read an article, a popular article, wherein the author stated that electrofishing does not harm fish. Well, as we all know, this certainly is not universally the case. Add to the motivation, the crew is trying to get work done, and it's a whole lot easier to say, not to worry, not a problem. This is not fair to the public, though. I think a better answer, if true in the particular situation, is that electrofishing can cause harm if used improperly and the crew is following best practices. This implies that the operator is familiar with the literature, understands fish causing factors of electrical waveforms and handling, and has equipment with the fine controls necessary to manage electrical outputs. If the stars align, electrofishing, in fact, may be less injurious than other approaches as seining for benthic species. I should add an important point, however, that some protocols for uses such as assessing biotic integrity require efficient capture and often preservation. In certain other cases, as with trout sampling, a balance must be struck between sampling efficiency and injury. For biotic assessments, sampling efficiency may trump injury concerns, and the biologist should be honest about this. Best practices for biotic assessments, I believe, should emphasize efficiency to minimize area exposed to electric fields, which could be a part of their response. Given this to be the actual case, I've answered the second question by saying that electrofishing is the best or an efficient way to capture fishes as a given location, then follow up by providing some examples of how capturing fish will benefit yields to them or benefits to them or to the public. Like this will give us a stronger basis for length limits or creel limits, or this gives us a good assessment of stream health.
Great. I think that'll be useful for me in the future, I know for sure.
Definitely, for all of us, Emily. What are the basic components of different electrofishing units, Jim?
I've previously addressed this question in a general way, but I'll add some detail. All units require a power source, usually generators in boats and batteries in backpack units. In streams too large for backpack units, personnel use generators to achieve a larger, stronger electric field while waiting. These systems usually operate from a generator in a towed barge or on an adjacent bank. As an aside on safety, bankside operations often involve multiple electrodes operated by independent pairs of personnel. These can be large operations involving many people. More accidents have occurred during bankside electrofishing than any other method. In these situations, a supervisor should supervise and refrain from catching fish. Insulated wiring is the next basic component, and it should have a rating that accommodates the highest voltage and current expected. Connections and switches should be waterproof. The wiring connects to the key component, a control unit. Today, these units are commercially produced, and the most expensive component of an electrofishing system. And also, I might add, because they're commercially produced, they're well tested and very safe. A control unit modifies the alternating current from a generator or the direct current from a battery to produce a fish catching electric waveform. Finally, the electric waveform is sent through insulated wires to the electrodes, which transmit the electricity to the water to form the electric field. Electrode designs are too numerous to describe here, but all are made of some sort of bare metal, usually aluminum or stainless steel, and are cylindrical in shape, either suspended vertically in the water or bent into loops. To complete a circuit through the circuit and water, electrodes must have opposite polarity. With direct current and pulse direct current, the negative electrode is called the cathode and generally is not useful for catching fish, but does repel fish, which is often useful in barriers. The positive electrode is called the anode and is the fish catching electrode because it attracts fish.
Jim, what are some equipment modifications that biologists should know about?
Electrofishing systems have been modified in many ways to achieve specific purposes. Most are active or moving methods for capturing fish. I've already mentioned tow barge and bankside systems that are hybrids of boat and backpack electrofishing. Electric seines are modified with a series of hanging electrodes arranged in alternating polarity. These seines are not used for catching fish, but instead are used to herd fish into a block net for capture. Alan has mentioned a passive method that employs pre-positioned electrodes on the substrate. These systems function like a trap with the electrodes electrified after fish re-enter the disturbed area. Then there are electrofishing systems that aim to control fish by directing them to a certain point, such as entry to a fish ladder, or repel them with fish barriers, often intended to prevent upstream movement of spawning fish. Electroanesthesia has become a popular method of controlling captive fish for processing, such as length measurement or implantation of radio tags. It is an effective alternative to chemicals because chemicals often require minutes to induce anesthesia and then allow recovery. A low intensive electric field in a tank will immediately induce anesthesia, from which fish will immediately recover without harm. Fish can be safely handled in the electrified water either with or without insulated gloves, depending on the electric field intensity. A further refinement for electroanesthesia are electrified gloves of opposite polarity. Insulated gloves are covered in a flexible wire mesh and electrified with a battery. And holding the fish, by grasping the fish with both hands, it immediately induces electroanesthesia.
Thank you, Jim. Ellen, can you define alternate current, direct current, and pulse direct current? What are the advantages or disadvantages of each type of current?
Okay, here we go. Alternating current first. Alternating current is household outlet current. So in alternating current, the voltage output follows some sort of a sine wave pattern. The important thing is that the anode and cathode alternate at a high frequency, usually 50 or 60 times per second. Thus, there is no constant anode or cathode, and thereby no target for the fish to be attracted to. Fish have non-directional inhibited swimming and immobilization, tetany, or rigid immobilization is easiest to achieve, and that condition has the highest probability of injury, actually. Due to the large swings in voltage and current resulting from the sine wave pattern, alternating current can be the most effective waveform in the conductivity extremes, both low and high. Direct current is uninterrupted battery output. The anode and cathode are constant. Direct current is best at causing attraction of fish to the anode, which can be of great advantage in drawing fish out of undercut banks or vegetation. The attraction response is impressive. It's almost like magic sometimes. Direct current is considered least harmful to fish in general and is the initial recommended waveform for trout sampling. The main drawback is, since the waveform is constantly on, direct current is highly energy consumptive and usually has the most limited conductivity range for effective sampling. Last is pulse direct current. Pulse direct current is the most commonly used waveform in fishery sampling. Pulse direct current is chopped up direct current, basically. The initial idea for pulse direct current is to have off times in a direct current waveform that will lower energy demands while hopefully having the same advantages as direct current. While energy demands are reduced and thus effective conductivity range is increased over that of just direct current, similar advantages may or may not occur. So pulse direct current, due to the large number of combinations of pulse frequency and width, make it a complicated waveform to work with. Selected pulse direct current frequency and pulse width combinations may or may not cause attraction to target species. Injury rates may be slight or may be substantial. Tetany is easier to achieve than when using direct current, but less likely than with alternating current. Now, this is an area ripe for more research. I should end by saying that a common pulse direct current waveform used in for warm water sampling is 60 pulses per second and 25% duty cycle, which is a 4 millisecond pulse width.
That's great. I feel like going out backpack shopping right now, actually. So Jim, what are some of the parameters that are set on the different systems, like voltage and frequency?
Well, voltage is the key control on all electrofishing units. No electrofishing unit has a separate current selector. Instead, the current changes in direct proportion to whatever the voltage is selected. Pulse direct current is the most commonly used waveform, as Alan said. It features an on and off pulse at a frequency of, say, 10 pulses per second at the low end and up to perhaps 400 pulses per second at the high end. However, most electrofishing employs 15 to 20 seconds, 15 to 20 pulses per second for catfish, 30 pulses per second for salmonids and other cold water fishes, and 60 pulses per second for warm water fishes. Besides selection of frequency, a modern control unit will allow adjustment of duty cycle or the percent of on time during an on and off pulse cycle. For example, if an on-off pulse cycle is on half the time and off half the time, then the duty cycle is 50%. Most electrofishing is done at 20 to 25% duty cycle.
Fantastic. Emily, do you want to throw out our next question?
Yeah. So could you describe fish behavioral response to AC, DC, and then PDC fields and how you discriminate when the appropriate level of response is detected for Allen?
Well, I think it's important to first mention that there are several named reactions in electric fields. Jim summarized them for fisheries work by categorizing responses as escape, inhibited swimming, and immobilization. Now, inhibited swimming includes both non-directional and attraction movements. So one reaction in common to all waveforms is the escape response. There's no need to describe that reaction. As I had mentioned before, alternating current or AC causes inhibited non-directional swimming, a shuddering or transverse oscillotaxis, and then immobilization. Often immobilization is the rigid or tetany response. A sign of this is flared gill covers. With DC, the primary response is inhibited swimming that often includes an attraction or taxis to the anode. Closer to the anode, immobilization occurs, and often that state is with relaxed muscles or narcosis. Tetany can occur with yet higher field frequency, or intensity, but it's less likely with DC. Note that you may see another response termed pseudo-force swimming, wherein the individual goes from narcosis immobilization to an upside-down oriented swimming attraction toward the anode. From an electric field perspective, DC is advantageous relative to many pulse direct current waveforms because there is a greater difference in field intensity between the points of inhibited swimming and immobilization. And with pulse direct current, reactions vary by frequency pulse width combination and by species. You could get attraction and narcosis immobilization similar to DC, or instead non-directional inhibited swimming and even tetany similar to AC.
So I think that really brings up the question, and I'll direct this towards you, Jim. What are some potential injuries fish might acquire due to these methods? How prevalent are those injuries and how can they be prevented?
Well, when a fish swims, it does so by contracting muscles on one side while relaxing them on the other. And this produces the classic S-shaped swimming motion in fish. Injury can be caused by an intense electrical field that forces muscle contraction simultaneously on both sides of the fish. This result is typically compression, misalignment, or fracture of spinal vertebrae. Muscle contraction may also produce compression of capillaries that rupture and cause hematomas in the muscle tissue and visible bruising, often called brands, which they are actually not in some species. Bleeding from the gill arch also can occur. All of these injuries are caused by using too much electrical output. Frequency set too high is generally the most important, most common cause of fish injury, followed by too high voltage. Duty cycle is generally unimportant compared to frequency and voltage. The best prevention is the reduction of frequency. If frequency is standardized and cannot be changed, then voltage should be reduced to a threshold level that is just enough for satisfactory capture.
Thank you, Jim. Those are really some critical points. Are there impacts, Allen, that might be assessed at a later time, such as on reproduction or growth? And how could one mitigate those types of impacts?
Well, negative impacts have been demonstrated in reproduction of such species as Arctic grayling, red shiner, and razorback sucker. Likewise, there have been some studies indicating negative effects on growth of species as rainbow trout. But to be fair, other studies have shown minimal impact or imperceptible influence on growth or reproduction in the wild, particularly if the frequency of electrofishing is not too high. I think a more important consideration may be for hatcheries if sampling is for broodstock collection, where lowered reproduction potential could cause a management problem. If no other collection gear is available that could be less harmful, electrofish with direct current or low frequency pulse direct current at the minimum amount of voltage or current needed for adequate capture. Use larger size electrodes at both chocking. Do not reintroduce captured fishes back into an energized field, so you net them one at a time. For wild populations, in the case of no information otherwise, a less risky approach is to avoid sampling of spawning aggregations or over reds, or during times of increased egg sensitivity as middle to late epiboli. So in summary, I think approaches to reduce sublethal effects really are similar to those used to reduce risk of trauma.
A quick follow-up question, Alan. Can you define epiboli?
Not really. It's a stage in egg development, and oftentimes that it's known, it's temperature degree days. And so eggs typically, when they're first water hardened, they have little susceptibility to harm from electrofishing. But as time goes on, they peak in their susceptibility and their effect, or, you know, bad effects that can happen to them. And then it decreases to hatching IUP, where they have very little sensitivity. And so in some places, you know, for Arctic grayling, they know that, well, middle epiboli, that occurs about 14 days in a typical year past spawning. And so they can, the idea is you can get a bit of a clue about what period of time you should avoid known spawning areas for some species like Arctic grayling.
Okay. And as Jim mentioned, like, be sure to check specific published literature for your target species. So that was great. Jim, can you define fish conductivity in case any of our listeners have yet to work with this variable? And can you explain what makes some species more conductive than others?
Well, let's start with the definition of conductivity. It's a measure of the capacity of any medium, air, water, a solid, to conduct electricity, and is measured in microsiemens per centimeter. Water conductivity is a measure of any water to its ability to conduct electricity, and fish conductivity measures how well a fish body conducts electricity. Larry Coles, who we've talked about before, developed the concept of power transfer theory for electrofishing. The theory says that when two conductivities, that is fish and water, are equal, all of the power in the water is transferred to the fish. When they are not equal, more power must be applied to the water to achieve the same power transfer as when the two conductivities were equal. Greater differences between the two conductivities requires even more power applied to the water to achieve the same power transfer at equality. Power transfer theory has been verified in several independent studies and is now the foundation for understanding how electrofishing works. Power transfer then depends on the ratio of water conductivity to fish conductivity, what we call the mismatch ratio, that takes a value of 1 when the two conductivities are equal and can range from 0.3 to 3.0 over the common range of water conductivity. Fish conductivity is estimated in a test tank by measuring how well power transfer occurs at different water conductivities. An estimate of fish conductivity is achieved at the water conductivity that achieves maximum power transfer. In other words, when you have maximum power transfer, the water conductivity indicates what the fish conductivity is. We now know that fish conductivity varies between about 50 and 150 microsiemens per centimeter, which is a very small variation compared to the range of water conductivity that we encounter in natural waters. In the upcoming second edition of the Standard Methods book, what some people call the Black Bible, AFS now plans to use 100 microsiemens per centimeter as a constant value of fish conductivity for all species and sizes of fish. Some species are more conductive than others, even though this makes little difference in standardized electrofishing. But we do know that fine scaled fish, such as trout, are more conductive than heavily scaled fish, such as carp. In other words, the scales can provide a certain amount of resistance to current flow. But we don't know much more than that. Many more studies are necessary before we can understand how fish conductivity varies among species and sizes of fish.
Really interesting, and kind of leads into my next question. So for Alan, can you give examples of fish that are particularly sensitive or insensitive to electroshocking?
Well, Emily, by sensitive or insensitive, I'm going to assume you mean to capture or not injure in this case. First, I'll start with an insensitive species. Biologists listening who have electrofished in southern Florida or say Puerto Rico or Australia know this one, tilapia. The common description is that tilapia, when in an electric field, swim in a somewhat vertical circle and then take off, escape. And to be captured by electrofishing, they have to be brought very close to electrodes or herded up next to the shore so that the electrodes can be brought into close proximity. We've done some tank studies on tilapia, and they require very high amounts of current to be immobilized, you know, relatively speaking. So one hypothesis is that since they evolved in the presence of electric predators, tilapia developed a resistance to electricity. For sensitive species, blue and flathead catfish float up to the surface from very, very low current or voltage gradient levels. And that can be a problem though, as individuals can appear far from the electrofishing boat. Trout and whitefish seem more sensitive than warm water game fish. Suckers also seem more susceptible to electric current.
So to kind of follow up with that, what adjustments can be made when you want to target a specific species?
Well, I think this question is one of the big quests of electrofishing. What are the most effective waveforms for specific species? We have some conceptual ideas for underlying basis, but essentially this is an empirical endeavor. One way is to pay close attention to the field for fish reactions while using different waveforms. A possibly more efficient approach is to use lab experiments for determining these candidate effective waveforms and then test those in the field. We have successfully followed this process for a handful of species as alligator gar, silver carp, snakeheads, and coaster brook trout. Coaster brook trout in Lake Superior are sampled now by the Fish and Wildlife Service using 300 pulse per second pulse direct current. A finding from a study we did there. Jan Dean and the Columbia Fish and Wildlife crew has found that a 5 millisecond pulse width, such as that in a 80 pulse per second, 40% duty cycle waveform, causes some attraction response and increases capture of Asian carp. And Jan has seen similar behavior in alligator gar. I should say that approaches at times are based not only on efficiency, but also on trying to keep injury rates low. So lab and field experiments and tests are needed for objectives as these as well. So otherwise, voltage or current adjustments by water conductivity can follow a species-specific standardization table. So voltage and current values in the standardization table are threshold or close to threshold levels that are the minimum amount needed for effective electrofishing at a given water conductivity. Sometimes changes in gear type or configuration is warranted. You know, electrified quadrets can drastically increase catch rates in certain habitats. Electro design changes, for example, deep water cathodes may increase capture of deeper running riverine species. Speaking of agent carp, lab and field electric waveform experiments were combined with advanced net trawl technology to come up with a unique electrofishing boat, the Papier or Magna Carpa, as it's effectively known in Missouri.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of the, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I think our listeners would want to know if there's like a YouTube video they can find on that boat. Is that the case, Alan? Right. Can they see that operating?
Oh yes, there are some YouTube videos, and I can send you some of those, okay. Sue, and maybe put out for folks, you bet.
Okay, I'll include those in the show notes. Did you have a question to follow up with that for Jim, Emily?
Yeah, so how does fish size and then also vertebral count affect electrofishing efficiency and potential for injury? I'm wondering if you could specifically reference your own work with American eels, Jim.
Well, we know that fish size and vertebral count are important factors in determining the risk of injury for a fish in an electric field. Fish that swim by tail thrusts, and we call them tail swimmers, such as largemouth bass, have low vertebral counts of about 25 to 30, and therefore they have robust spines that are resistant to injury when muscle contraction occurs. Larger fish have a disproportionately larger dorsal muscle mass and are at greater risk of spinal injury than smaller fish with relatively less muscle mass because of the force of muscle contraction. Body swimmers such as trout that swim using the classic S-shaped body movement may have many more vertebrae. Many salmonids have 60 to 75, and this is, of course, much more than tail swimmers. They need a more flexible spine because of their nature of swimming. However, those spines are less robust because of the high number and smaller size of the vertebrae, and they're subject to greater risk of spinal injury. Add to that the fact that the muscle mass of body swimmers is relatively greater than that of the tail swimmers, and you can see that body swimmers have a kind of a double whammy working against them. If a bass and trout of the same size are exposed to the same electric field, the trout will be at greater risk of injury. Excuse me. A former student of mine, Mike Coleman, and I compared spinal injury rate in American eels, a body swimmer, caught by pulse DC electrofishing at 30 pulses per second, and trap netting. Electrofishing was known to be more effective at eel capture than trap netting. These eels had vertebral counts of about 120 and were very large, about 1 meter long. Injury rates in eels caught by electrofishing was 60%, whereas those caught by trap netting was 15%. You can see that a lower frequency of 30 pulses per second was no guarantee of low injury risk in these large fish with very high vertebral count. Because the eels were caught only with 30 pulses per second pulse DC, we could not say if injury would be reduced by using a frequency lower than 30 pulses per second. To our knowledge, further studies of frequency on injury of American eels have not been conducted.
So a follow-up question for Alan. Alan, are there instances where it's actually difficult not to harm fish, such as in highly conductive waters? If so, have you seen conditions like that? And how does one go about reducing harm to species and people?
Well, Sue, the short answer is yes. At times it is difficult not to harm fish. And it does seem intuitive that injury is more likely at high conductivity, but that is actually not the case due to the power transfer concept as demonstrated by Steve Miranda and Theodore Henry. Injury is most likely where power transfer from water to fish is most efficient. And as Jim has explained, that point is where fish conductivity and water conductivity are equal. High and low water conductivity tend to shield fish from high injury rates. So if water conductivity is around, say, 100 microsiemens per centimeter, be particularly careful not to overpower the system. Standardization of voltage and current helps. Jim has demonstrated that using direct current or 30 pulses per second or less pulse DC for trout sampling often reduces injury rates. Try to avoid tetany or immobilization in sensitive groups as trouts and salmonids. We are finding that direct current results in very low injury rates in darters. If you are sampling benthic fishes in wadeable habitats, especially darters, keep the anode away from the bottom or jammed under undercut banks to lessen exposure intensity. You may not be able to use gear types as electrified quadrats that have electrodes on the bottom and potentially in close proximity to fish. Especially with sensitive species, net them one at a time. In other words, do not reintroduce capture individuals back into the field to net more fishes. Now, this might lower your capture efficiency, but it may be a sacrifice needed if injury is a concern.
Thank you for that. So I recently read in a 2010 study by Miranda and Kidwell that continuous DC was less harmful to fish than pulse DC, which, as I recall, is a current use for lamprey, and that hemorrhages and spinal injuries were higher with high pulse frequencies or the pulses per second, and mortalities were higher with low pulse frequencies. So, Jim, I've seen you've done some similar work with Chinook juveniles. Can you help explain those results and also share what you found with your own work?
Well, it is true that the Miranda Kidwell study reported that DC was less harmful than pulse DC, and this finding has been confirmed in other studies. Although injury rates were higher at high frequencies of pulse DC and mortalities were higher at lower frequencies in the Miranda Kidwell study, the authors conceded that the results were ambiguous. This resulted from different results among species instead of uniform findings. The clear result was that the authors recommended the use of DC, not pulse DC, where non-game fish populations are small and perhaps threatened. The study by Mike Holloman, John Holmes, and myself on juvenile Chinook salmon focused on the healing time required to reveal the true number of spinal fractures. Healing creates a calcium deposition at the fracture, which is more easily detected by X-ray in these small fish. But hematomas are more easily detected by filleting the fish after electroshock exposure. This conundrum is solved only by having enough fish to fillet some and allow healing time in others.
So what are some examples, Alan, you can give of when electroshocking is effective for fisheries research or management, and perhaps when it's not?
Well, electrofishing can be effective in streams with large rocky substrates or in vegetated areas with a lot of downed coarse woody debris, or say in cypress swamps. In other words, electrofishing can be more effective than other gear types in complex habitats. Usually, unless deep water electrodes are used, electrofishing is a shallow water technique, probably 3 meters deep and less. You know, maybe it would be easier to say when electrofishing is not very effective. Electrofishing is less effective for pelagic species or deeper running fishes, unless significant allowances are made in the power source, the control box, waveform, or electrode size. Electrofishing effectiveness is limited in water conductivity greater than, say, 2,500 to 3,000 microsiemens per centimeter, unless the water body is small or very shallow or narrow. Now, this conductivity limit may be much lower, though, depending upon the gear and model. So other gears need to come into play as fall trap netting for crappie in Missouri reservoirs, spring sampling by fike net for brook trout off Isle Royale and Lake Superior, gill netting for striped bass in Smithfield Reservoir in Virginia, hoop netting, trot lining, and drifting trammel nets or gill nets for sturgeon in the Missouri River, and deep water trawls in big rivers or surface trawls in deep tributaries for assemblage, you know, level sampling. These other fisheries gears, nets primarily, can be more effective and, in my opinion, is complex or more complicated to correctly deploy than electrofishing. But when you need to combine gear types, that's where it gets interesting.
Jim, where would you like to see this technology improve?
Even though basic electrofishing technology such as waveform selection has remained unchanged in recent decades, the commercial manufacturers are making significant improvements in equipment. I previously mentioned the recent development of anesthetizing gloves. Many backpack units have the option to produce dual frequency pulse DC, a waveform that produces packets of a few pulses at very high frequencies, such as 500 pulses per second. And these packets are delivered at very low frequencies, such as 15 pulses per second. This waveform reduces risk of injury, even though it must be used at higher voltages in order to capture fish, but do not seem to increase injury. Recent developments using GPS technology to modify units to receive location signals and create an on-screen track of the sampling path that is overlaid on a map of the landscape and can be viewed on screen on the backpack unit itself. In summary, I believe that the technology improvements will occur more on the data acquisition side of sampling, like automatic upload of data to sites distant from the field. And to some extent, this is already available.
Wow, thank you. What are some important considerations for making informed purchase decisions, Alan? Because they can be pretty expensive units. Mm-hmm. So how can you help our listeners walk them through the process?
Well, sure. Sue, here's five. The unit can effectively sample the water conductivity range you'll be sampling. The unit has accurate current and voltage output metering. The unit has fine voltage, frequency, and duty cycle controls. The model can generate the waveforms you need for effective sampling, and it goes without saying, the model has safety features required by your agency safety policy.
And assuming that folks have a research permit, because this is not just something that people would just buy otherwise, what are some companies that listeners can contact to purchase electrofishing equipment?
Well, sure. I'm limiting my comments to U.S. companies. There are a number of companies in the United States, of which there are three major ones. My bias in this response is to recommend companies that have equipment useful for doing standardized sampling. They have adequate safety features and have large conductivity sampling ranges. So the three I'd mention for now in alphabetical order are ETS Electrofishing in Madison, Wisconsin, Midwest Lake Electrofishing Systems in Polo, Missouri, and Smith Root Incorporated in Vancouver, Washington.
Thank you for that, Alan. Jim, in the fisheries techniques chapter, you stated early on that the technique is mostly a freshwater technique. What are some examples of effectively using this technique in brackish or saltwater?
Well, this is a fairly recent development. Electrofishing was considered to be effective only at water conductivities less than 5,000 microsiemens per centimeter. However, a study by Lischke, Dean, and Pickworth that was conducted in Victoria, Australia, and published in the 2019 volume of the Transactions of the American Fisheries Society evaluated a boat unit manufactured by the Grassel Company of Germany. Field testing demonstrated that the unit will successfully capture fish at conductivities up to 30,000 microsiemens per centimeter. This is the equivalent of brackish water. Also, electro trawling, the use of electrodes on trawls to move fish off the bottom and into trawls, is now being used on an experimental commercial scale in the North Sea. However, these trawls require power sources only available on ships, whereas the Grassel unit can be used on conventional size electrofishing boats.
Wow, really interesting. Finally, I'd like to ask you a longish question based on what I usually use the technique for, and that's backpack shocking in streams. Typically for that work, we block net our reach and do three passes to maximize both the species accumulation curve of the fish represented. And then reach length from the literature should be anywhere from 20 to 40 times the wetted width of the stream. My point is, in streams, we're very careful to try to catch as many species as we can. Whereas when I met you both, I think it was in 2019 alongside the Truckee River in Reno during a Smith Root and Nevada Department of Fish and Game kind of demo, they kind of welcomed us to join them on their usual survey. They were barge and backpack shocking a larger system with one pass. And of course, with boat shocking, you can't block net. So my question is, do you see a difference in effectiveness across gear or system size in electrofishing with either abundance or richness?
Well, there's sure been a lot of attention paid to this question, Sue. Yes, differences exist in efficiency across gear types or stream size. Good illustrations of gear differences are from gear comparison studies and from gear efficiency calibration models. These gear efficiency models are used for adjusting catch per unit effort to population estimates by predicting catchability or estimating catchability given a particular technique, particular habitat conditions, and particular protocols, number of passes, and whether block nets are used or not. And often an efficiency factor that is included in these prediction equations is some measure of stream size. Getting back to your protocols, interestingly, the 35 to 40 times wetted stream width sampling length especially tends to correspond closely with two meanders in a sinuous type stream. Thus, major habitat types and their fish populations are represented multiple times at a sampling site. You get more cracks at them. Often this protocol is applied with tow barge or backpack shocking, with or without block nets, and is based on species accumulation curves by stream length, where you want to have a sampling distance needed to capture on average, say 95% of the species present. These length rules are a result of capture efficiency of the particular gear types, either with block nets or not, and are for species richness estimates primarily. Now your work is very thorough, as three pass data can generate abundance as well as catch per unit effort estimates, and the block nets should increase accuracy. I think your approach should be a standard. However, programs often are faced with the need to minimize cost and cover more area. To do more under these time constraints, reducing sampling effort is a solution, opting for a single pass instead of multiple pass protocols requires some evaluation work, though. A couple pertinent questions are working out the single pass detection probability of target species and testing the relationship between single pass CPUE and multiple pass abundance estimates to derive, say, an index of abundance with single pass. Another consideration is if these data are being used as an index, say for the index of biotic integrity. An application of this, the evaluation will center on whether there are differences in biotic indices generated by a single pass and by multiple pass protocols.
That's fantastic. Some other time, perhaps we can kind of dig deeper into unpacking all that. So actually, before we finish with the questions, we did want to talk a little bit about fright bias. And so what is fright bias, Alan?
Well, Sue, fright bias is when fishes leave the immediate sampling area due to physical disturbance from sampling and are not captured. In other words, they flee before the electric field is strong enough around them for a capture-prone response. One approach is to reduce disturbance by sampling remotely, as with throwable anodes, parallel wires, or electrified quadrats. Another technique is to enlarge the field by using larger sized electrodes, or applying higher voltages, or increasing pulse frequency, or say using an attractive waveform as direct current. You know, as we all know, a common approach is to ambush good habitats by approaching with the electricity off in a boat or in a backpack, and at a close distance, energizing the switch, engaging the switch. If significant fright reaction can't be prevented, employing block nets can help.
So, and this is the last question. So I admit I've actually started going through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife course materials, your papers, the fisheries techniques chapters, and still feel woefully unqualified to question you on how much you know about this technique. So completely open question, what would you both like listeners to know about electrofishing?
Well, this is Alan. I'd like them to know that not all equipment models are equally effective or necessarily acceptable for the work they're undertaking. I'd want them to know that there is equipment out there that has accurate electrical output meters and fine controls such that they can learn what settings work and what doesn't. And they can standardize by current or voltage. Remember, you can use the electrofishing app. And related, for them to know that there is a scientific approach to purchasing equipment, particularly in taking into account the conductivity sampling range of a model.
And I'll add that your listeners should know that it is very important to fish at or near threshold to achieve satisfactory capture rates while minimizing trauma to fish. Using the same settings under all conditions is not a good practice. Even at the same locations, water conditions, especially conductivity, may change and require new settings to achieve threshold. Instead, take a few minutes before getting samples to generate data by using trial samples and adjusting the settings up or down to achieve threshold levels. If one will find threshold by trial, then record the settings, the electrical settings, plus water conductivity and temperature, I can promise that they will better understand their success and limitations.
Thank you, Jim. I'm going to play that back to my fisheries techniques class every time we go out. It's perfect. Emily, would you like to lead our guests through the 5 classic fisheries podcast questions?
It would be an honor, yes. So I'll start simple. What is your favorite fish for both of you?
Well, Well, that's actually a tough one. I'm going to go with the almost only West Virginia fish, the candy darter.
Alan loves the candy darter. I'm going to go with my favorite Arctic grayling.
No, blame you.
Great. Okay. So what is your favorite memory from your career so far, Alan?
Well, working with crews to improve sampling, as with Coaster, Brook Trout, and Lake Superior, that's my favorite. A recent opportunity was working on the Mekong River in Laos, teaching crews there how to electrofish and how to standardize their sampling. Hopefully that process we work through there will form the basis for electrofishing operations on other parts of the Mekong in the future.
Very cool. And Jim, how about you?
Well, Sue, so far is the operational phrase in your question, because I'm so far into my career that I'm not quite sure how much longer it's going to last. But hands down, my favorite experience was serving as a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years after retirement at the University of the South Pacific in Fiji.
Great. Okay. And then what about your dream job or location?
Well, yeah. So I'm getting, this is Alan, I'm getting close to retirement. So for fun, I'd like to do the old biological surveys for fish in great places like the southeastern U.S. or in Queensland, Australia.
Very neat.
And Jim here, I've already realized my dream job as unit leader of the Alaska unit at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Over 28 years, I led projects all over the state and saw some amazing things.
Okay. And then if money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
Boy, you know, this comes up all the time, you know, but I would say that testing approaches to improving electrofishing efficiency and standardization would be mine.
And mine would be better understanding of the effects of electroshock on fish and other animals.
Great. Then last, but definitely not least, if there was one point or principle you could get, or you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Well, I would say, do not just select the automatic setup on your backpack. Do what it takes to understand waveform settings, keep good metadata records, and standardize by voltage or current learn.
And I am so with Alan on that.
Yes, very important.
Jim and Alan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And Emily, thank you for sharing hosting duties with me.
Of course.
I thank you both for educating us on this amazing fisheries techniques. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you both, how would they do that?
They could access my Fish and Wildlife Service email, just at my name, Alan Temple, Alan_Temple at fws.gov, fishwildlifeservice.gov.
And they can reach me at my one and only email address, jbreynolds@alaska.edu.
Thank you all. And remember, do not just select the automatic setup on your backpack shocker. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Great job.